B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, a man who has both casual and formal golf shoes, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. You know, there are definite tiers, if you will, to PGA Tour events. There are the majors, then there's the TPC and World Golf Championship, and then there's a tier of upper echelon events held at places like Riviera, Pebble Beach, Bay Hill, here at Quail Hollow, and this week at Muirfield Village Golf Club in Dublin, Ohio, just outside Columbus. This course is to Jack Nicklaus what Augusta National was to Bobby Jones. It is his. It is his design. It is his masterpiece. And it has been his toy to be constantly tinkered with. It's also been consistently ranked in the top 100 courses in the world for almost 50 years and is the only course to have played host to a PGA Tour event, a Ryder Cup, a President's Cup, and a Solheim Cup. Additionally, it has also staged a U.S. Junior and a U.S. Amateur. Today, we're going to have a distinct Memorial Nicklaus vibe as we will revisit a conversation had with Jack Nicklaus II, Jackie, most known as the man on his dad's bag for that historic 1986 win at Augusta. But he's also a great player and designer of his own note. However, we begin today with someone you've never heard of, but we'll give you a little behind-the-scenes peek at Muirfield Village Golf Club. He's a friend of mine and spent time as an assistant pro there working for Jack Nicklaus. This is Kevin South.
Were you originally from Ohio? Is that how you came about, you know, getting in the golf business at Muirfield Village, or what's your background?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Richmond, Virginia, and was working at a local club here, and my boss at the time, the head pro there, had worked down in North Carolina at Treyburn for a guy who was a head pro or assistant pro at Muirfield, so there was a connection there. And my wife wanted to go to grad school in Columbus, so we kind of put it all together, and I was lucky enough to get a position when she went to grad school and worked at Muirfield Village.
So I guess it's not too dissimilar from just about any other job. It's who you know that gets you there, and it's what you know that keeps you there, because I imagine that's a pretty coveted position.
Yeah, it was a pretty grueling interview process, but once you're there, you know, it's a pretty good gig. I got the chance to play quite a bit of golf. It's one of the last old school clubs left in the country where the, you know, the pro, they really want their pros being players. And the downside was we didn't do many lessons, but we did a lot of member and guest hosting when we were playing 4 or 5 times a week. So it was really good for my game, and it was a lot of fun.
Kevin South's a former assistant pro at Muirfield Village, site of this week's memorial. He's our guest taking dead aim. I guess I didn't realize this, but there are actually two golf courses within Muirfield Village. There's the country club at Muirfield, and then there's Muirfield Village Golf Club, which is where they hold the tournament. Are the two related in any way?
Not really. Muirfield Village is a planned residential community. If I had to guess, maybe there's 2,000 houses in it. And within that community are the two courses. The country club is a traditional family-style country club with a pool and tennis and all that. And then the golf club was built really to host the Memorial Tournament. Jack designed both of them, but the golf club is golf only and is pretty exclusive.
That's what I was going to get to. I mean, every town has their quote-unquote exclusive clubs. Here it's Charlotte or Quail Hollow or Myers Park. You live in the Richmond area. There's CCV. There's Kinloch. So that's an apt comparison. That's sort of the neighborhood Muirfield Village occupies.
Yeah, although I think the tournament, the Memorial Tournament, brings a little different level and expectation with the course. I mean, it is the top course in Columbus, but it's also nationally ranked. So it kind of, you know, when you walk on the property or when you work there or you're a member there, it kind of gives you the feel that, you know, you're at a little different level than even the top courses in other towns.
Well, that's an interesting statement, because when you think, you know, people who know golf, and you think Columbus, Ohio, I can think of two off the top of my head that make me go, wow, it's better than those courses. Scioto is a legendary golf course, as is the home course for the Buckeyes. The Scarlet course there is also a great course. So in your opinion, or in others' opinion, Muirfield Village is a better golf track than those?
Well, you know, Scioto and Muirfield are very comparable. Scioto is an old school Donald Ross course, and Muirfield Village is, you know, a new big stadium type golf course. So they're very different. I think they're equal as far as quality. But again, I think because you have the ongoing Memorial Tournament, you know, more people are familiar with Muirfield Village around the country than they would be with Scioto. But Scioto, you know, is excellent.
We'll get to this more in just a minute, but you already brought up the members at Muirfield Village. Do they have a sense of pride about the tournament being held there and other things that are held at that golf course? Or, you know, sometimes here, you know, the members at Quail Hollow, I think, get tired of hosting a tournament from time to time.
Yeah, the members at Muirfield really have a sense of pride. I mean, the course was built for the Memorial Tournament. So, you know, when they joined, there's an expectation that, you know, most of the members are going to volunteer for the tournament. When you watch it on TV, you'll see in the background, you'll see a bunch of people wearing gray jackets. And those are all the members that are wearing their sport coats, you know, around the course, and they're volunteering. So the expectation is there to participate, and it's something that is talked about and prepared for year-round. It's a huge tournament. There's a lot of volunteers, and most of them are members. So there's a great sense of pride.
Kevin South is a former assistant pro at Muirfield Village, side of this week's Memorial. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. You mentioned the grueling interview process, despite working for somebody who was a friend of a friend of a friend that could get you into Muirfield Village. At any point in this interview process, did you have the sweaty palms because you knew you were going to have to sit down one-on-one with Jack Nicklaus?
No, not at all.
Oh, God.
I don't know if I'd have made it through that process. But, no, at the time, there was a pro there, Jim Deering, longtime pro who had been there from when the club started. He actually was a former assistant pro at Scioto, and Jack knew him from there. But Jim Deering's a gentleman, and you know, it was just one of those interviews, couple interviews where you get the question that you just dread that you can't answer. And you know, one of them for me was, you know, he asked me if I brought my clubs, and actually I did not bring my golf clubs. And he kind of looked at me, you know, with a little twinkle in his eye, and says, how do you think you're going to become a golf professional if you don't carry your clubs around with you? So it was just, you know, kind of some heckling there, but it was a good time.
Wow, you had a 50-50 shot, because you're thinking, if I show up with my clubs, they're going to think I'm expecting to play, and I don't want that. And then come to find out they wanted you to have your golf club. You were damned if you do and damned if you don't.
That's right, exactly. I guess I could have had them in my trunk, but I was traveling from Virginia at the time and didn't bring them with me.
Arnold Palmer was the son of a golf employee. As such, the stories of how well he treated those that worked at his clubs are legendary. Jack was a child of privilege, having grown up playing at Scioto. How did he feel and treat the guys who worked as the pros and his assistants, or did you have much contact?
Yeah, there wasn't much contact. He was in two or three times a year. Obviously, he was into the tournament, and then he would come in the years that I was there, he'd come in for the member guests, which was in the fall, and then occasionally he would come in ahead of the tournament, just, you know, if they were doing a renovation, one of the holes or something, he would come in early spring and check on it. But every time I saw him, he was a gentleman. He was very nice. He was, you know, would come up to us and talk to us. I think he had a lot of respect for us working in the industry. And I did, fortunately, the last year I was there, get a chance to play with him. So it was a great, great time.
Thanks for bringing up the alterations to the course, not to belabor the Palmer comparisons, but Arnold was constantly tinkering with Bay Hill and Latrobe until the day he died. How much annual altering of the course was Jack prone to do?
Something pretty major every year. I don't know if it stemmed from, you know, what he saw happening down at Augusta National with the Masters tournament, but the years that I was there was at least one hole every year to get a major renovation. And when I mean major, like it was closed for months. I recall the fifth hole, which is the par five with the fairway, with the creek that runs through the middle of the fairway, that they reconfigured that. It used to be a creek. Now it's more of a pond. I think in 2010, they did a major renovation on number 16, which is a par three, and now one of the hardest holes on the course. When I was there, it had the deepest bunker on tour at the time. It was like 8 or 9 feet in the front. So it was a well-known par three at the time. But again, he, you know, had some complaints, I think, and just didn't like the way it played for the tournament. So he did a complete renovation of that hole.
Now, how long did you work there? What were the years that you worked there?
I was there 3 seasons. I was there from 96 through the end of 98. And at that time, that was, gosh, I can't remember. I think Greg Norman won 1 year. BJ Singh won. Scott Hoke might have won. It was kind of around the time that Paul Azinger, I wasn't there when he holed out from the bunker on 18 to beat Payne Stewart, but that was right before I was there.
As you watch the tournament now, and I'm sure you'll watch it this weekend, does the course almost look unrecognizable to you from some of the major changes? Because I know, look, the 18th hole to me looks completely different than it did just, you know, 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, 18 really does, mainly to me because of the changes to the clubhouse behind it. The clubhouse is totally different. It used to be two separate buildings between the actual clubhouse and then the tournament pavilion, which is kind of to the right of 18 green. And I can't remember, it's been a handful of years, but they connected those two buildings, and it really changed the look of that hole from the fairway up to the green. But in general, I don't think Jack has done much, made many changes to the shots into the green. The course to me has always been about the approach shots into the green, and they're so difficult. And he's done some minor things on some of the holes, but in general, most of the holes, the approach shots into the green look pretty similar.
That's pretty much a signature of most Jack designs, though, no matter where you are. I always think of his course as being second-shot golf courses. He always gives you places to land off the tee, but there's always a forced carry or something about that you know, risk-reward if you're going for the par five. There's definitely risk involved. Or if it's a par four, you've got to carry some bunkers or it's an elevated green. And I guess, you know, Muirfield's a shining example of that.
Definitely. It's by no means easy driving course, but there are areas where, if the second shot is extremely difficult, he'll give you a little more room off the tee to try and get you in the fairway. I think the par fives are, you know, some of the par fives out there are pretty short, so they're pretty demanding off the tee. And then the second shot going for the green, if you're going for it in two, is very difficult. 15 comes to mind. It's a very tight driving hole, and if you get it to the top of the hill, most of those guys are hitting irons into that green, and that green from 225 yards is very difficult to hit.
Kevin South is former assistant pro at Muirfield Village, side of this week's Memorial Tournament, our guest taking Dead Aim. Look, this is the most northern state I've lived in, so I have absolutely zero, I mean not a concept of not being able to play golf year-round. Ohio gets snow. At times, Ohio gets a lot of snow. How long was the club, quote-unquote, closed each year? And as an assistant pro at a club that's closed, what do you do during that time?
Yeah, so we were – the pro shop was open through Christmas, through right up to Christmas. We had a Christmas sale, holiday sale. But to be honest with you, when Ohio State football starts, the weekends out there are pretty dead. And if you were lucky enough to get a nice October, November day on the weekend, you might get 8 or 10 players. But if there was a home Ohio State football game, there was no one out there playing golf. So we were, usually if I was working on a Saturday morning when there was a home game, I was watching the football game in the pro shop. But I would say the season there is beginning of April through the end of September. The weather there is not great. It's one thing I don't miss about Columbus, Ohio, is the weather. Even in the summer, it's kind of hazy and cloudy. But, you get you get 6-7 months of playing time, and then in the winter we shut it down in January and February. So the years that I was there, I was going down to Florida trying to play some little mini tour stuff in January and February and did some sunshine.
Kevin, the Memorial is static on the calendar. You know what's coming every year. When you were there, was there ever a late snow or an especially cold spring that caused some real problems getting the course ready?
I don't remember snow or ice or anything like that causing problems. What did happen for many years, and I think if I remember this correctly, right before I was there in the mid-90s, they moved it back a week. I think it used to end on the day before Memorial Day, and they moved it a week later on the schedule. But the rain, it always rained. I mean, there was never a tournament that I was a part of where there wasn't rain delays and multiple ones. And my responsibility when I was there was working the merchandise tents around the course, the external merchandise tents, and it was really difficult when the weather hit. So they're dealing with rain mainly. The winter, you know, I don't recall snow or anything like that affecting the tournament.
One more geeky agronomical question for you here. This course not only hosts the Memorial, but over the years, it's played host to U.S. Amateurs, Solheim Cups, President's Cups, Ryder's Cups. I think in the 3 years you were there, surely one of those events took place. What's the prep time like for those, especially since you had to host a PGA Tour event earlier in the season? And in terms of closing the course and getting it ready for that, I mean, is that especially tough on the membership?
Yeah, not really. I mean, they closed the course of the Memorial Tournament a week before, but they're working, you know, to put up the exterior security fence and things like that for months. The TV towers are permanent, so they stay. They take the tops off, but the poles themselves are there permanent. So when they had, I believe the Solheim Cup was there in 98. You know, it's a couple-month process, but for the members, really, it's not that tough for them. They close the course down a week before, but up until then they're playing. I mean, the course is in great shape, obviously, up right up to the tournament, through the tournament, so they're getting the benefit of playing it, you know, in those types of conditions.
Get you out of here on these. Kevin South, former assistant pro at Muirfield Village, side of this week's Memorials, our guest taking Dead Aim. Number one, tell me about the milkshakes.
I think they're voted every year number one on tour. You kind of have to be careful as an employee not to get too many of them and get reprimanded. But they're the best I've ever had. I don't know what their secret is, but they made them in the men's grill, and it was kind of like a special treat. And especially if you had a guest in, they just perfected them. So the tour players love them.
And give me your best "I can't believe I'm with Jack Nicklaus right now" story.
First tee, I knew he was coming in. It was right before the Memorial Tournament, a couple days before, and I didn't think I was going to get a chance to play with him. And I was back in the club repair room, and the caddy master banged on the door. I was kind of upset because I knew it was my last year, and I wasn't going to get a chance to play with him. And I was regripping some clubs or something, doing some club repair, and the caddy master banged on the door and Oak came in and said, "Get your shoes on. They're on the tee waiting for you." So I got to run out and no warm-ups and nothing and get to play 14 holes with him. So it was very special.
You got to play a lot of great golf as an amateur and as a professional over the years. Was there ever anything more nervous in your life than the first tee shot you make with Jack Nicklaus standing there?
No, never. Never. But he's a kind of a jokester, so he lightened the mood a little bit, and it was a great time.
That's a former assistant pro at Muirfield Village Golf Club, my friend Kevin South. And when we return, part one of a conversation with Jack Nicklaus II, Jackie, as he takes Dead Aim at Growing Up Nicklaus, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music.
Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Jack Nicklaus II is a golfer, golf course designer, father, and son of one of the most famous sportsmen in history. Jack, I'm going to start with a question that I'm betting no one has asked you, or at least not asked you recently. How young were you when you realized how special Barbara Nicklaus is?
Well, you threw me off here. I thought you were going to ask me about Jack Nicklaus. Good for you. Guys, you did catch me off guard with that. You know what? I can answer it in a number of different ways, but I'm still realizing what a wonderful lady Barbara Nicklaus is. She's doing so much today. For the Nicklaus Children's Hospital and here during the Memorial Tournament this week for the Nationwide Children's Hospital. And, she dedicates her time to helping people. She's so kind always to everybody. Doesn't matter who it is or where they're from. She is just complete kindness and just wants to help. Her memory is insane. She remembers details about people that, when I have a tough time remembering a first name, she remembers full names, children, grandchildren's names. I mean, and she keeps in touch with everybody. I can go on and on, but I will say this. There's no question my dad's career would not have been what it has been without my mom supporting him. She kept everything in order in his life. She managed us kids, managed the household. There's no question that without her support, there wouldn't have been the career that Jack Nicklaus has had.
Seriously, though, you're the first of your parents' five children. Do you remember when it might have occurred to you that people didn't treat your dad or your family the same ways that other people's families were treated? At what point in your life did it become apparent to you that I'm in sort of a different situation here?
Well, I think my mom and dad, like I say, sheltered us from that, but they did not thrust us out in the limelight. They kept us very grounded. And they taught us good principles and fundamentals and good morals. It's just my dad was in the public eye, but I can go back to some little things that I said. Someone apparently, I don't remember, but apparently I said when I was about 6 years old, when asked, "What does your dad do for work?" And my response was, "Oh, he doesn't work. He just plays golf." And it was never a big deal. At least mom and dad never made it a big deal, and they were always at all of our sporting events. And honestly, we didn't see ourselves as any different than anybody else.
I'm glad you brought that up, because this is something that I've always admired from afar. The priority that your parents made of being parents. In fact, I remember watching your nephew play at FSU a few years ago in bowl games and seeing your folks in the crowd. And they looked so satisfied and so comfortable in the role of just being Nick O'Leary's grandparents. And I was trying to think how to put this. Arnold Palmer always wanted to be recognized as Arnold Palmer. And that's not a bad thing, and that's not a knock on Arnold. But am I correct in saying that when your parents would show up at your ball game or at a recital for your sister or at Nick O'Leary's football games, they were more than happy and content in the skin of just being mom and dad or grandparents?
I think that's a really accurate statement. Arnold, I love Arnold Palmer, and he's so dearly missed. But I think Arnold was really comfortable in a room of 500 people that he hadn't met. They were soon going to be his friends. And I think my mom and dad would more gravitate to smaller groups and maybe a more intimate setting.
Everyone's wired a little bit differently. But Arnold and my dad, boy, they had an amazing friendship over the years. But to get back to the role of grandparents and parents, they have completely embraced that. He was at Nick O'Leary's. My mom and dad were at Nick O'Leary's events. In fact, I don't know that they missed a single college football game,
wow,
home or away, in the 4 years that Nick was at Florida State. They're at Buffalo Bills a lot, watching him play. But that's one of 22 grandkids. My mom and dad often have to split their time up, mom going one direction, dad the other, so they can attend all the kids' games. I mean, that has been a priority for mom and dad. And it was the same way when we were growing up. I cannot recall many events that mom and dad missed. Mom was our scorekeeper in our basketball games. Dad was often on the roof of the gym overlooking the football field, calling down plays to our coach. I mean, they were very involved with our lives. And I can remember our football team, my brother Steve and I were playing out west of Lake Okeechobee against our crosstown rival. And it's a very difficult place to get to. That was a Friday night game. My dad was playing the World Series of Golf up in Akron, Ohio, and he played his round. He was lucky enough to play that morning. Got on a plane, flew down into this remote area west of Lake Okeechobee, got to our game before kickoff. Wished us good luck. Watched our game. I will mention we won the game. And he slapped us on the butt, said, "Nice game. We'll see you guys Sunday night." Got on the plane, flew back to Akron. I'm sure he got back at 2 in the morning. And I wish I could tell you he won the tournament, but I don't think he did that year. But that's the type of sacrifices that that they've made for us that really have made an impact in our lives. And, such a great role model for myself as a parent.
Jack Nicklaus II is our guest taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. I want to ask about your sister just for a second, Nick O'Leary's mom. You have three brothers and you have a sister. And I would think, even in an age, and I think you were really lucky in that you grew up when you did, I think it would be so tough to be Jack Nicklaus's kid right now with social media and with the constant scrutiny and the 24-hour golf channels. I think the pressure would be immense. I'm not saying it wasn't pressure-filled. But your sister had it a lot easier from a pressure standpoint being Jack Nicklaus's daughter than you guys did being Jack Nicklaus's sons. Is that correct?
Well, I think we all... we all had our own experiences. I think there's a lot of positives and there's some negatives. When it comes right down to it, we all had great parents, and we're lucky we still have great parents. Nan has done a great job with her five kids. She played sports. Matter of fact, she probably had the best golf swing of any of my siblings, but she just never really played. She played volleyball at the University of Georgia, and my parents went and watched her play there, like she did with all of us. I don't know that I'd say she had it easier or tougher. I think we're all in kind of the same boat, and we've all been very supportive of each other.
Speaking of your playing career, and I guess I had sort of forgotten. For those that may have forgotten like me, Jack Nicklaus II had a hell of an amateur career. Like his father, he won the North-South Amateur, which to me, look, there's the U.S. Amateur and there's the North-South Amateur. That's how much I think of that tournament. And you won it in 1985, but I was looking at the years surrounding 1985. Listen to some of these names that put their name on that trophy. Hal Sutton, Corey Pavin, Keith Clearwater, Davis Love III, Jack Nicklaus II, Billy Andrade. That's six or seven names out of 8 years. That's a heck of a time in amateur golf in this country, huh?
Oh, I had a really lucky week. It was so much
stop.
Fun. I had so much fun. It was kind of neat. My dad was on his way to the Memorial Tournament, which in fact we're playing this week, and so he's on his way up. I'm sure he thought that I'd, maybe not qualify for match play, and I did. And I think he probably thought I'd maybe get beaten the first round, and I won the first round. And what happened, he eventually ran out of clothes. He called my mom each night. He says, "Well, Jackie won again today, and I'm going to have to get some more clothes. And I think by the week's end, he had no anticipation of being there, you know, through the finals. And, of course, he was there. He watched every shot that was played. And I think he was probably worn out by the time he got to the Memorial Tournament. But it was a really fun time and to play college golf and amateur golf. And I feel really blessed that I got to rub shoulders with some of those great players. And, you know, I never had the next career like those guys did. But, you know, I'm probably getting off on tangents, but at the time, you know, Davis Love, we played on the same team in North Carolina. He was a dominant player, but probably the most dominant player at that time was Scott Verplank. And Scott was out of Oklahoma State, and, you know, he was one of those guys that was so good, you just couldn't understand it. And I remember I had won the North-South on Sunday, I believe it was, and that night I flew down to Greenleaf near Orlando in Florida to play the NCAAs. And I remember walking on to the tee, and I was always in awe of Scott Verplank, and Oklahoma State was warming up, and Scott stopped his warm-up, turned around, and started clapping for me. And that really meant a lot to me. It still does. I mean, that was just a really nice thing to do for somebody that, you know, was the king of amateur golf at the time, to recognize, you know, me for something that I had done. It was really the first major victory that I had, you know, ever had in amateur golf, really.
Well, Scott Verplank, always known for being a classy guy, and that story really illustrates it. Jack Nicklaus II is our guest, taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. So let me do some timeline work here. If you are the reigning North-South amateur champion in 1985, when you're on the bag in 86, you're still the North-South champion, and you're caddying at the Masters? I mean, at some point, do you not look at your old man and say, get somebody else. I'm the North-South champ, Pop.
Oh, I was. I had a chance, had I played a little bit better in the fall of 85, I would have made the Walker Cup, and I would have been playing in the 86 Masters had that happened. I played in the British Amateur later that year, and I got beat in the quarterfinals by David Curry. He ended up winning the tournament, and oddly enough, I saw David Curry at the Masters in 86. So, I think had I made the Sweet 16 at the Western Amateur, that was another hurdle that would have gotten me into the Masters. So, rather than playing in the Masters that year, I got to caddy. But boy, what a ride that was in 86.
That's Jack Nicklaus II, Jackie. And up next, he takes Dead Aim at what it was like to be on the bag in 1986 for his father's historic sixth Masters win and more. Presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Hey, we're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Continuing now with our conversation with Jack Nicklaus II. You know, we all remember that, of course, and I really enjoyed the Golf Channel did a tremendous piece on the 30th anniversary last year where we learned a couple of things that I had never heard before. But in the moment, when you were in it, when your dad and you were in it, and immediately after it was done, did you realize how big it was or how big it was going to become over time?
I didn't realize how big it was going to become, but I knew it was really big at the time. You know, Dad hadn't won for several years. It was my first time caddying for my dad at Augusta. I'd caddied for him many times prior to that. And it was a growing significance throughout the week, but particularly on Sunday, you know, a little bit on the front nine, but really on the back nine. When he started gaining some momentum and the crowd really rallied behind him, the applause that he got was just amazing. They embraced him. And it was an embrace, not just for what he was doing that particular Sunday afternoon, but it was, I really felt it was an embrace for what he has meant for to the game of golf, what he's, you know, meant for, you know, so many people as a role model. He embodied so much that is good, that the people, I think they appreciated what he was doing that day, and they appreciated what he had done throughout his career. And there was such a well of emotions as my dad approached every green and every tee. I could see him tear up at every junction, and it was amazing that he could regroup and perform. And, certainly it culminated into, a hug that was very natural on the 18th green that I'll remember forever.
Now, that hug was very public. And then, of course, you have the multiple ceremonies of the green jacket. You have the dinner with the members afterwards. And there's a lot of hoo-ha that goes on after the Masters that no one really knows about. And it's not till later that evening when perhaps you get back to the residence that you guys had rented in Augusta for that day. Or maybe it even came later. That first moment, privately, when it's just you and your dad, what was said?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't know that there was a lot of discussion. I mean, by that time you're exhausted. They put the green coat on. Well, let me back up. You're in the heat of it. You know, I'm just trying to not to screw up as a caddy. My dad's hitting these great golf shots, and he finishes and signs a scorecard, and they take him over to the Jones cabin, which is just to the left of the 10th tee. And it's the first time I'd seen my dad nervous the entire day, because, and my dad explained that to me later. He said he felt like he could control his destiny all day long up until the point where he holed out his last putt. At that point, it was out of his hands. He did all that he could do, and he was nervous. And, we had the TV on, and he was kind of pacing back and forth behind the couch in the small room there at the center of the Jones cabin. But, we didn't talk a lot. we were just intent on seeing what was going to happen. And, of course, when Kite missed a close putt and Greg Norman had the pitch out at 18 and missed the putt on the green as well, that's at that moment we knew that Dad had won the Masters. And we all had a great embrace. His sister, Marilyn, was there. And it was just, and his mom and my mom and myself, just our group was in that room. And it was a great embrace and happiness. And then, of course, they escorted him right out to, meet the crowd and to the cheers. And at that point, what happens is, they do the coat ceremony, and then there's a small ceremony after that with some of the members, and then, frankly, we got on an airplane and came back home that night. So we probably got home at 1 or 2 in the morning, so there was probably more sleep than talk.
At that point in your career as a player, you mentioned you were playing in Carolina, you were the North-South Amateur Champion. In a private game in South Florida at that point, had you beaten your dad?
Yes. Maybe 1 out of 100 times.
but you had done it. So you could say, hey, I've beaten the Masters champion.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
But again, I learned early on, Charlie, that we played a lot of golf. And my brother Gary and I both learned if we were up on him at all, we might have him 1 or 2 up with a couple of holes to play. And every time we brought that to my dad's attention, I'm telling you what, putts went in the hole from all directions. I mean, he had a switch that he could just turn on. So we learned not to bring it up. And occasionally we got to the last hole without him realizing we might have him one up. But again, that was not very often.
Jack Nicklaus II is our guest taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. I know you're involved with the Nicklaus Design Company. You had your own design business for a while. And to me, I think this is a supreme talent. I've never understood. I have friends that can walk into old houses and old architecture and go, if I take this wall out here and do this and this, I never can see that. And the ability to be able to walk out on an expanse of land, a piece of property, and envision a golf course, I think that's an incredible talent and an incredible vision. Is that something you were born with, or is that something that you were taught by your dad? How did you develop that skill?
You know what? I think it's a learned skill. I've always enjoyed, you know, the artwork part of it, you know, drawing and whatnot. But I've followed my dad around for years and years, and ever since I can remember, you know, here at Muirfield Village. He did this golf course. We opened in 74. He started the design in 72. So that would have put me about 10 years old at the time. And I followed him around. And I listened and I watched, and he'd ask my opinion as I grew up. And it's just, I felt like for me it was a learned skill. I love the work. Matter of fact, you did mention I had my own design group. I have my own design jobs, but I've always worked under the Nicholas Design Company.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so my dad and I have been a partner on a lot of jobs. And I can't tell you how amazed I am with his ability to see things, just like you were explaining. I oftentimes get caught up in minutiae and not, you know, as they say, see a tree through the forest. Well, he seems to be seeing a project from 20 and 30,000 feet really, really well, and he's got such a creative mind. And I've tried to just listen and learn best I can, because I don't think there's anybody better than him in the business. And it's really been a lot of fun, not just creating something that's going to be here well beyond my lifetime, but more importantly for me to be able to work with my dad.
A couple of questions about that business. Number one, I had a friend who was up at the Greenbrier last weekend, and I asked him, and he did not know the answer. There was that project that was going on with Trevino and Palmer and Player and your dad, all yeah. four designing that. And with Arnold's passing, I'm wondering, where does that project stand now?
Arnold will have his design, his head design guy will be there and interact with Gary Lee and my dad now. So Arnold's input indirectly will still be there, and they're continuing on with that project.
And when one has a contract with the Jack Nicklaus Design Company, how much of a hands-on situation do they get from your dad?
If anybody has ever been part of that process, they'll know that it's complete hands-on with my dad. A lot of guys will just lend their name to a job. My dad would be the antithesis of that. He is... he loves it. He loves getting out there. He loves getting muddy. He loves being creative. He loves sharing ideas and thoughts with the developer and engineers. And he's out there with the guys that are pushing the dirt, that are sitting on the bulldozers, our design guys, which he's assembled an amazing, talented group of design associates and coordinators. And as a group, we kind of put our heads together, Dad being our leader, and he is completely hands-on. And, you know, I was talking about it with my mom today. My dad will promise, you know, one level, but always tries to over-deliver on that promise. That's just the way he's wired. And literally, he is out there, you know, a lot.
Jack Nicklaus II is our guest, taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. Get you out of here with a couple of questions about where you are right now at Muirfield Village. I saw you earlier this week in the ceremony with Greg Norman, and I really love all the things that they do up at that tournament at the Memorial. Can you just describe how special a place? You mentioned that it was an early design. It was 1974, but it seems to have a very special place in the heart of your father and your family. Can you describe the feeling Muirfield Village has for you?
It's a home away from home. Mom and Dad, when I think about it, it's incredible what they have created here when you think about the age. So 1968, my dad and three friends, there's four that founded the club here: Pandel Savick, Ivor Young, Bob Hogan, my dad. They were at Augusta National during one of the competitions there. They were sitting at a lunch table together, and they said, you know what, we really should try to do something like this for our hometown back in Columbus, Ohio. Let's give back to Columbus, something that's been so special to our lives. So anyway, they bought this property in 1968. My dad is 28 years old at the time, which I have a son that's 27 right now. It's just, for me, it's unbelievable that, you know, he could have that foresight to, you know, get a piece of property and try to create something, give it back to his hometown. Well, he went on, and this golf course was really the first golf course built as a stadium-type golf course. His membership, the first 10 members, honorary members, he went to Japan. He got an Asian member. He got a black member. He got a female member. He tried to be as diverse as he could well before anybody talked about diversity. He's doing this as a 32-year-old young man. And of course now here we are, 40 some years later, and he's created a tournament that the best players in the world come to. It's played on a facility that is second to none, Muirfield Village Golf Club. And the players love coming here because I think my mom and dad took what they've learned throughout the years of traveling around the tour, and they've implemented it here. They've got, great child care services. They have, how they handle the players coming in and coming out. They make it as easy as they can for these guys to perform at their best level. And going beyond that, giving back to the community, there's over 100 local charities that benefit from the tournament each year. From inception, we've given close to $27 million. This year, we'll shell out about $2.5 million to the lion's share going to Nationwide Children's Hospital. So there's so many good things. It's not just golf. We're saving children's lives. And it's something that mom and dad have created. And again, I don't know if I mentioned, but honoring greats of the past. We honored Greg Norman this year, and Greg gave a wonderful talk yesterday about growing up and learning the game of golf through reading my dad's books. As a matter of fact, 55 Ways to Play Golf and Golf My Way, the two books that he received from his father, I think when he was 15 years old, and it's just there's so many little stories that I could tie into. I can go on and on, but it's a very, very special place.
All right, let's get out of here with the most important question about Muirfield Village. You're old enough to remember the old international that was at Castle Pines in Colorado.
Sure.
And that golf club was famous for one thing and one thing only, and that was its milkshakes. And lately, I'm hearing a lot of smack being talked about the brilliance of the Muirfield Village milkshake.
It's really good.
Putting all bias aside, which is the better milkshake?
Well, I actually played in the international for a couple of years, several years back before electricity. And
there was enough electricity in the skies out there.
But anyway, there has always been a fun competition. Actually, that they do a player poll. And one of the questions is, where are the best milkshakes on tour? And one and two went back and forth for many years between Castle Pines in Colorado and here at Muirfield Village Golf Club. And my vote goes to Muirfield Village in the Memorial Tournament. I actually had one 2 days ago. My wife's all over me. I had a little heart procedure a couple weeks ago, so I'm eating so much lettuce I'm going to turn into a manatee, I think. I had a Buckeye milkshake, which is the chocolate and peanut butter, and they added a little bit of malt, and just the richest, creamiest ice cream, and it was good. That was a treat. I hope she's not listening to this this interview because she'll know that I eat a milkshake.
That's Jack Nicklaus II, better known as Jackie. I'd also like to thank Kevin South, former assistant pro at Muirfield Village, for his time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what in the Sam heck we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there right now are links to articles on Stanford's big NCAA championship win, why Hank Haney must go, and Peyton Manning roasting PGA Tour pros. It's really funny. Hey, weather-wise, perfect summer weekend in the Carolinas to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And I'll tell you what, if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.